Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome today. On our way to our conversation, I want to remind you what this day is in life and our history. This is today before we join our conversation, because in some ways it kind of fits the complexity of our conversation. This is the anniversary of the Independence Day that Israel celebrates. It is called Independence Day. It's called Liberation Day by many people who live in Israel, the liberation of the Jewish people. The Palestinian people call this day Nakba, or the Day of Catastrophe. And we can look at history and life from a number of perspectives and see it in many different ways. I'm thinking about a man that I talked to just before he was assassinated and killed. His name was Giuliano Meir Kamas. He was an Israeli and a Palestinian. His father was a Palestinian. His mother was an Israeli. His mother fought in the War of Independence, or the war that people look at as the Nakba, if you're Palestinian. And she was a member of a group called the Palmach. The Palmach were a group of radical Israelis, many of them communists, all revolutionaries, who formed the commando brigades that fought the British. She fought in the Palmach, but when they went into a Palestinian village in Beersheba, in southern Israel, and were told to move out Palestinian families, she resisted, said she wouldn't do it. She wouldn't move them out. That's not what she was there for. She was there for the liberation of her people, not for the oppression of another people. And she left the Palmach. And they had a son. And their son was named Giuliano Meir Kamas, who was a man who saw his world as both people. And he was a man who was assassinated and killed. Actually, just before we were about to interview him again, he and I have been having email conversations before he was assassinated and killed in the Jenin refugee camp where they ran the Freedom Theater. We still to this day don't know who killed him, killed Giuliano Meir Kamas, but he was a man who embodied the hope of the future, realizing that that land belonged to both and that land meant the future or death of both people. So it's interesting, you can look at the question of what is good, what is evil, what is right, what is wrong, through many lenses. And when we kind of contemplate what happened in Cleveland with Ariel Castro holding these women hostage, one woman for 10 years, is that evil? What do we mean by the notion of evil? I was thinking before we started on the air, talking to one of our guests, the Reverend Dr. Bernard Keels is in the studio with us, who was born in Birmingham, Alabama, who grew up, he's just a little younger than I am, grew up in Alabama during the time of the bombings. Is that evil? Is that what Hannah Arendt, one of the great philosophers of humankind, called the banality of evil? One of our guests might disagree with me on that. We'll talk about that in a moment. But the banality of evil, the men who blew up that Baptist church, the 16th Street Baptist Church, were men who went home at night and kissed their babies goodnight, hugged their wives, ate dinner with their families, made barbecue, went to church, and killed four little girls. Ariel Castro may not have kissed his wife. He beat his wife. He beat his children, had sex with his children, held women captive. Is that what evil means? What do you even mean by it? Does it exist? Do we create it? Where does it come from? We are joined here today by four interesting thinkers, all of whom work here at Morgan State University, so happens, which is not a bad way to celebrate our new daytime show here at 9 a.m. We are joined here in studio by E.R. Shipp, associate professor and journalist in residence here in the Department of Communication Studies at Morgan State University and a winner of the Pulitzer Prize, former ombudsman at Washington Post. Always a pleasure to have her in the studio. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Shipp, good to have you here. We are joined here in studio by the Reverend Dr. Bernard Keels, director of the Morgan University Chapel, a man who came to the world of media and then took a different direction. Reverend Keels, good to have you in the studio.
It's good to be here.
Dr. Joe Pettit is with us, associate professor of philosophy and religious studies and a religious studies advisor here at Morgan State University. Good to have you in the studio with us as well.
Great to be here.
And by phone, Dr. Josh Miller, lecturer of philosophy and religious studies here at Morgan State University. And welcome, Dr. Josh Miller. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, I threw that Hannah Arendt thing out. But folks, you by the way, can join us. We are live, 9 a.m., brand new day. We love it. 410-319-8888 is the number here. You can join us at steinershow@gmail.com. If it's easier at your desk at work to write to us, you can tweet us at Mark Steiner. Jump onto our Facebook pages, which I'll be checking to see if you've written us at either one of the Mark Steiner or the Mark Steiner Show Facebook page. And you can join us there, 410-319-8888. And I know you were saying that Josh Miller, I know that you are an expert on Hannah Arendt. That's one of your areas.
I work on her.
One of the things that when I said to one of my producers that I saw this as is this the banality of evil? And you said to him, no, this is not the banality of evil. So start there.
All right. So Hannah Arendt used the term banality of evil in a few different ways, but she used it primarily with reference to Adolf Eichmann. And Eichmann's, she described him as a desk murderer. So what was important about Eichmann was that he was capable of engaging in horribly evil acts, but from a distance and without really ever understanding what he had done, or at least that was her claim. She described him as a buffoon, a clown, not a monster. And I think at least one way in which they're not analogous is that Ariel Castro seems to have been a monster. I mean, to have acted monstrously, in the presence of the people he was harming. It was important that Eichmann really never could conceive of what he was doing. He never really realized what he was doing. He was clueless in that way. Castro, I think, just the opposite. We have evidence that he wrote a suicide note at one point describing himself as a sexual predator. He knew that he was evil. He did not commit suicide, unfortunately.
So how
I guess that's one way in which they're different.
They are different. And so how do we wrestle with things like that then? What does that mean to us when we see somebody do this kind of act that happens every day in American society? Three women are killed every day by their domestic partners in this country.
So I guess the other way in which Arendt meant this is that evil is banal because there's really nothing to see or understand in it. You can't think it through. There's no radical root. There's nothing that you can understand. You'll just be frustrated. Goodness has depth. It's radical. But evil, there's no insight. There's no difference or important difference between monsters and ordinary people. That's why it was possible for Castro to, seem to his friends and to his neighbors as a kind of an ordinary guy.
Well, the fact that he was kind of an ordinary guy to the outside world makes it so chilling when we think about we could not recognize evil in him. If there is such a thing as evil, shouldn't we have seen it? What if he played salsa music well? He played bass. I think he was one of the best bass players in Cleveland, I read. So what that he knew how to barbecue ribs? Shouldn't we have seen evil? I mean, that's scary that you could be having normal community activities. He, in fact, apparently helped to lead the search parties for one of these young women and provided food and other things to those doing the searching. Why couldn't anyone detect evil?
What makes you think, Professorship, what makes you think we can detect evil?
I'm just saying, you want to think. I don't know. That's my point. We think somehow we should know evil. We should smell it somehow. It should be apparent.
I think it'd be much easier to get rid of if we could do that. Mm. I think that what makes, if we're ever going to get around to an agreement about what evil is, I'm not sure we ever will, but if it were obvious, I think we would be much better at confronting it. I think its lack of obviousness makes it far more insidious, far more capable of working its way into our cities, into our daily lives, and therefore all the much more difficult to get rid of.
Dr. Keels.
One of the things that so disturbs me about life is that much of perception proceeds from where you've been. The Sankofa bird in Africa always reminds me that when you are moving forward, you must look back. I find it very interesting in the case of the Palestinian and the Jewish people that one would call it a day of celebration, the other would call it a day of catastrophe. I think that part of what we do is that we loosely define words culturally. We look through a lens to be able to say that this exists because of this. And I think, Professor Shipp, you're really on to something. The reason why we can't see it is that we don't take enough time to know the person. The person dictates the action, and not necessarily the action is because of the evil in the person. when I was a little boy, I remember the first time going to a water fountain that said for colored only. And the question I asked my mother was interesting. Do white people and black people drink different water? For a five-year-old, that was the only logical thing I could think of. And the fact that somehow E would have been institutionalized to the point where the men who bombed the 16th Street Baptist Church were as ordinary can be in the context of their reality. So I would submit to you that it's very, very important that when I was in Israel during the Intifada, I found it very interesting to listen to a Palestinian and a Jew look at the same situation and see it and call it completely different. And someone said, who's right and who's wrong? And my answer was, it depends what side you're facing it from. Both are right in their own perception. And to me, that's one of the startling things about evil, that it exists sometimes because it's been so institutionalized that you expect to see it. I expected to go to a water fountain that said for color only. In fact, it's so crazy. When you were a six-year-old, you got to go to the restroom. You're in Sylacauga, Alabama, and there's no restroom for colored people. You hold your urine. And then you wonder, what decided this was right? And how can one people do it as a natural thing and other people are so oppressed by it that they feel compelled to acquiesce to the barriers that have been put in front of them? And yet it's a barrier of evil. Someone should have destroyed it from my perspective.
So let me kind of wrestle with some of this for a minute, because you've all said something fairly profound stuff here. So and I want our listeners to join us at 410-319-8888. Might be a tough way to start with your morning coffee, but give it a whirl. because it's around us, and we think about this. And I was thinking about, let's go back to Ariel Castro for a minute and pull out something you just said, Dr. Bernard Keels, and the institutionalization of this kind of evil in our society, how it happens, whether it's racism. In this case, though, let's talk about it in terms of misogyny, that in a larger sense, many cultures have institutionalized the idea that women are second class, that men are in charge, and even to the point that women in some levels even unconsciously become property. How do we extrapolate out of that what happens to a man like, and this is not forgiving him for anything he's done, but extrapolate out what happens to a man like Ariel Castro, himself abused as a child, but in a culture where women are to be controlled, where women may, in some senses, I don't know what happened to him as a child, but the women, I have no idea, but where women are to be controlled, and that he becomes the extreme of society's response to that institutionalization of misogyny. Every man's not going to hide a woman, but a lot of men have fantasies about control sexually over women. That's true. A lot of men do. And he plays it out to its extreme. So how do we wrestle with that? Because that does exist every day. Everybody doesn't do what he did, but it exists every day somewhere in somebody's brain.
Well, it does exist. It has existed forever. But I think we can't focus so much on Ariel Castro because he is such an extreme actor that it's difficult for quote-unquote normal people to even think they could know someone like that or be someone like that. The common theme of exerting power over women, I guess, is what we can focus on without so much putting Ariel Castro's face on it. And if we do that, maybe we can come up with a better approach to even discussing how we deal with this need for power.
Evil is the word that we're going to have to wrestle with at some point, because if it's just perspective, if it's bad for the Palestinians, bad for the Israelis, bad for women, then you can understand what we're talking about. It's something that some group dislikes. If we call it evil, we end up having to conclude that one or other group is right to dislike it, because it really does contravene something written in the fabric of nature that says this is evil, or at least in our reason, if you want to come up with a purely rational understanding of evil. Is it right to oppose the oppression of women? I think it is, But maybe some men think it's not. And if evil is just perspectival, we're stuck. We want it to be something more than just perspectival. And then we can start saying you are right to find the oppression of women wrong. And that's what we're hunting for here, I think. I hope it's not just perspectival. Because if evil is just a matter of perspective, then slavery is not evil. It's just horrible to be a slave, right? Misogyny is not evil. It's just horrible to be a woman who is being treated like property. I want evil to be real.
But I'll kill your head.
And it's organic sense. That's an argument. It probably makes sense. But when you look at it from the viewpoint of a meritocracy, who has greater value in life? Who gets to define what is and what is not evil? I wrote an article a few years ago on racism and stereotyping in language and media, and was quite amazed at the assumptions we make about people and their capacity to do certain kinds of things. You look at a young Midwesterner. Let me give a better example. A young white kid from Alabama with an accent. There was a point in which people believed everybody who had a Southern accent was evil and racist. That's such an untrue statement. But yet we take shortcuts in defining things because we don't want to go through the laborious efforts of actually looking a man or woman in the eye, hearing their story, reflecting on the value of their story, and then making a very, I think, organized, systematic analysis of what does it really, really mean. I never talked to a white person in a serious conversation. I was about 16 years old. So I really didn't know what their values were. Then I met a Jewish guy in New York named Charles Silverman, a guy who wrote a book called Crisis in Black and White. And I realized how similar our struggles were, yet how different they were. On some things, we fully agreed. And other things, it was like night and day. So if it is to be, why is it that we don't teach people to have a greater sense of understanding of diversity, cultural normative behavior, so that we put other factors into defining something rather than just a visual examination. Yes, it is horrible what Ariel Castro did, but it's even more horrible of what happens now in the issue of immigration and Hispanics, what happens in the issue of terrorism and Arabs. You know, I find it very interesting that one person can do something as a freedom fighter, as in Menachem Begin and Ben-Gurion in 48, someone else does something and they're terrorists.
Right.
Who defines what is what? So terrorism is more apt to be evil than a freedom fighter, yet I will submit to you that it's probably just as evil for someone in 1844 to split a church over North and South over the issue of slavery, convincing Christians that it's right to own slaves, and people saying, well, not that bad a deal. Well, it's a bad deal if you're a slave. If you're a black woman and you have to bear someone's children, breastfeed somebody else's children, be a concubine, and then someone say, well, you know, it wasn't that bad a situation. That's pretty severe. But again, how do you get to know there were slave owners who had a change, a transformation, if you will, like C.W. Newton, who wrote the song Amazing Grace. And it's amazing. He starts out as a slave ship captain, ends up with one of the most recognizable hymns within the Christendom experience. So personalizing it, to me, does a lot by way of offering substantive information that informs and really makes a person free enough to dare to call it what it is and speak for the other and to embrace the other. Sometimes no one speaks for the other until the media speaks for them.
So I'm trying to pull this together, what you just said. And just in terms of and Josh, maybe you can kind of jump in on this because we haven't had your voice back here in a minute. But I mean, there's different things. There's the institutionalization of things we call evil, and the difficulty of wrestling with that. But then, and how they translate into the acts of the individual.
So one thing I would want to point out is that there are, I think, two ways that we think about solving evil things, injuries, harms that we see arising. And I don't think that any of us would be willing to say that personalizing Ariel Castro could in any way change the way we view what he did. He kidnapped, beat, raped women over a period of a decade, which means that, you know, he had a very personal knowledge of them. He probably can tell you a lot more about these women than the media can. He knows them well. And he was still capable of treating them extraordinarily cruelly. And so one conception we have of how to deal with evil is we say, well, what we need is a moral imagination. We need to be able to see things from the perspective of the other. But the problem is that cruelty and sadism actually require that perspective of the other to function. If Castro's goal is to oppress a woman, he's interested in someone he can understand well enough to know that he is causing them harm, that he's terrorizing them, etc. And that's seemingly a failure of moral imagination, but not at the level of understanding. He understands what he's doing, and yet he does it anyway. And we would want to contrast that with something like institutional evil. And I too, I'm a political philosopher. I too prefer the sort of institutional evil story because I can conceive of how regular, nice folks could participate in institutional evil by not understanding what they're doing, because what they're doing is pushing paperwork. What they're doing is enforcing a rule. They didn't make the rule. But I think, the existence of people who can engage in terribly cruel acts with full knowledge of what they're doing and to whom they are doing them and that, what it's like for the person they're doing it to, is a real challenge to our desire to see something from everyone's perspective, to have this perspectival approach where, from my perspective that's bad, but from your perspective it's good. I think that's a challenge. There's something more than the moral imagination lacking in someone like Ariel Castro.
So when we come back from this break, I'm going to read a comment from the email that came in from Marty Mossberg, who is a Baltimore Sun columnist and an interesting conservative thinker who wrote an idea in. Listening to this conversation, so we'll I'll read that. But also kind of when we come back from this break is to kind of talk about, does free will or evil even exist? Because a lot of neuroscientists today are saying that it does not, that you have no free will. Even if you know you're doing wrong, you can't even make the decisions because of things happening in your brain. Is that part of it? Is that an excuse? Is that reality? So we'll come back to all that. Don't go away as we come back to wrestle with this notion of evil in society. What does it mean? 410-319-8888 is the number to bring your thoughts to the airwaves. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. We are joined here this hour by E.R. Shipp, Associate Professor and Journalist in Residence here in the Department of Communication Studies at Morgan State University, about to become its own school.
School of Global Journalism and Communication.
Mm. And E.R. Shipp is also, and we'll be joined later in the week by Duane Wickham to talk more about the school that they're creating here at Morgan State University. And E.R. Shipp is also a Pulitzer Prize winner, 1995?
Six.
Dr. Josh Miller, lecturer in philosophy and religious studies at Morgan State University. Dr. Joe Pettit, associate professor of philosophy and religious studies. I am religious studies advisor here at Morgan State University. The Reverend Dr. Bernard Keels, director of the Morgan University Chapel. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Do I want to go with Marta Mossberg's comment or go to – let's read her comment first, and then we'll go to this question of whether free will and evil do exist. And during the break, Joe Pettit here at Morgan State University was saying he spent the last year on sabbatical wrestling with religion and science. So I'll let him wrestle with this first, as we all do this. But Marta wrote in, "The divorce of moral significance from the words we choose likely will not end soon. One in three under 30 claim no religious affiliation, and so many of the rest of us view faith as a means to self-fulfillment rather than a worldview with a right and wrong. But no matter how hard we try to erase judgment from our vocabulary and culture, it cannot eliminate the dark side of human nature, because our language reflects how we think and vice versa. As George Orwell noted in Politics in the English Language, understanding, anticipating, and ultimately labeling evil will become more difficult for Americans."
Well, I think we would prefer evil not to exist because we don't want to be challenged in what we do. We do not want there to be a standard out there that can judge back at us and say, you're ignoring the fact that we have people enslaved in the United States now on a regular basis. We want to be shocked about Cleveland, but we have a human trafficking problem that is pervasive, and we're perfectly comfortable leaving it alone. We have problems in the city of Baltimore that would make anybody who spent a moment thinking about them deeply just weep, but we don't think about them. And it would be nice not to have to think about them because, frankly, we have better things to do with our time, right? You know, golf, dinner. Yeah, we don't want to believe, as Abraham Joshua Heschel would say, that God is at stake in injustice. And I think that most people who believe in God don't want to think that God is at stake in their lives, because that is an incredibly demanding standard to live by. So I think Ms. Mossberg may be on to something. It would probably be a healthy thing to have a more robust discussion of good and evil. But there are those who think that maybe religion should stay out of this because when you call it evil, you give it a status that it doesn't deserve. And it enables one group to feel justified in bashing another group over the head by calling them evil.
Well, maybe one of the reasons we have this idea of good and evil is because they needed to have ideas of good and evil when in religion, other places in society, because evil was that which you did not like. Good was that which is what you did like. And so we can look at good and evil in many different ways and what we define as good and evil.
And even before you start calling it religion, it's basically a way of preserving the society that you're creating. There has to be some line that you can't cross if we're going to keep the society together, wherever that society is. If it were the ancient Middle East or Baltimore streets today, you want to think there's some way that we can live together, work together, function. And so whoever isn't doing whatever we've decided must be the good for our society, that side is evil, I suppose is what we're saying. In the case of Ariel Castro, I guess he's frightening to us because we know that a lot of the things about him are the things that we are. Happy-go-lucky, we enjoy the company of our neighbors, all of those kinds of things. We know that. And we also know that we have our own secrets about ourselves. And so when we see that someone else had deep, dark secrets taken to this extreme, it really frightens us, and we don't know how to respond. The easy response is throw him in prison, charge him with a capital crime because he did kill babies or fetuses. Get rid of him. We've cut that evil out of our lives, out of our society. Now we can go back to the golf and to whatever else we're doing. But we still haven't addressed that gnawing thing in us that we could be Ariel Castro, couldn't we?
Right. And we could be Ariel Castro in many ways. He may reside in all of us.
Mark, can I challenge that?
Pardon?
I'd like to challenge that.
Oh, I haven't finished. But go ahead and challenge
it. I don't think anyone on the panel here could be Ariel Castro.
How do you know that?
I know some of the members of the panel.
Do you?
Well. And so I would just say that Ariel Castro is evil in a way that we are incapable of. Let me just speak for myself, that I am incapable of. But that, as Dr. Pettit pointed out, we are capable of ignoring evil, of being willfully ignorant to evil, in a way that might make us complicit in evil. And that's different from being able to look someone in the face as you beat and rape them. I think it's a little too easy to say that, we could all do it. I don't think that we have that in us. I mean, I will admit I don't know everyone, so I could be wrong. But
I don't think
we should be so quick to self-indict in this way. Even while I would say that the function of me saying this is partly to separate myself from his monstrousness, right? To say, okay, there are two kinds of people in the world, the people who can do this and the people who can't, and therefore I am blameless. I would say that is also false. I'm capable of doing things that contribute to evil by ignoring them, by participating in a way that's not quite so immediate. And those two are reasons for concern. But I am not capable of doing what Ariel Castro did.
Well, we don't have to limit it to what he specifically did. But the idea that we can have in our midst people who do bad things, do evil things, and we don't know about it, or we may turn a blind eye to make ourselves feel more safe.
And I think because when I was thinking about what you were saying, Josh, what I was about to say, and Bernard Keel, jump in on this if you would as well, everybody else too, that when you – all right. Maybe none of us in this room are capable of doing that. I hope we're not. But I also don't know everybody in this room that well. I've just met you, all of you, for the first time. So I don't know what lurks behind your closed doors, right? And if one out of two women, by some studies in America, and I think it may be even higher than that, have experienced, let's say, rape, what some men wouldn't consider rape, but women, and we, many of us do, and most women would consider rape. Now, if that exists, that's a lot of women. That's a lot of men committing those acts. So what does that tell us about what we don't know about how we can control whatever we can control about who we are and can't control?
A professor of mine, Bill Jones, said once that if you want to be a harmless preacher, just talk about the sins that everybody agree are heinous. Leave the rest of the stuff as sort of marginal. And I think what is really coming out of this discussion is this statement that I heard. I don't know who the author is, but it said something basically like, when it came for the Jews, since I wasn't a Jew, I said nothing.
Neither, right.
When it came from the gypsies, I wasn't a gypsy, so I said nothing. When it came for the homosexuals, I wasn't homosexual, I said nothing. It came for me, and there was no one left to say anything. I think therein lies a clear insight into how we are curiously silent in the face of some institutional evil. Now, what if a slave was sitting at the Founding Fathers when he wrote the Constitution and Declaration of Independence and realized that it didn't contain them at all? And yet we celebrate all these days, and I remember in high school getting expelled from high school because I challenged a teacher who asked us to write a stupid essay on Columbus Day. And my response was, you can't discover a place where people already are. And she looked at me like, I dare you say that. And so what it says is that sometimes that if you have the ability to write and to say what is and what is not, there may be a little bit of Castro in all of us that we are unaware of, never been in touch with. How could the Roman Catholic Church stand by when 6 million people were exterminated? I mean, how do you justify that in any regard? How do we stand by when more and more kids in Baltimore are not being educated to the level, and we realize it's only going to cause certain things about evil down the line as we define it? Nobody wants to see a kid, a 19-year-old kid in New Orleans, following a parade, shooting at people.
Right.
But I would ask you to look at all the things that maybe have contributed to that. Nobody wants to see, you know, the Fifth Ward in Katrina, but bodies floating down the street or in the Super Bowl. And so sometimes the evil is in our curious silence to say nothing. To me, that's a contributory factor to it. And one of the things that I would stress to us is that nothing is more liberating than to face your greatest fears and to realize that you have the capacity not to become that. A lot of people, when I was growing up, said that they wish every white person were dead because of what these four little girls experienced. Well, that's crazy, because a woman like Valuso comes down to Mississippi, you know, in a comfortable Detroit home and gives her life that somebody can vote. To me, you can't attribute that. Castro acted out in this real visible way, but what about the corporate attorneys that beat their wives? or rape their wives. What about, the people as late as 1970? My wife would get letters from a religious leader, I won't mention his name because I'll probably get fired, who would address the letter as Mrs. Bernard Keels. We send it back, and she was irate. She said, there's no Mrs. Bernard Keels here. To me, that kind of institutionalization of something allows us to say, well, at least it's not that bad. So to be an effective voice, you got to call it as you see it. Otherwise, someone else may be the victim of what you have not said and fall into this abyss where they're forever just labeled and trapped and hurt. Homeless people, I look at them sometimes and I think that everybody thinks that someone who's homeless has no vision or anything, no hopes. And so they deserve what they get. And is it always true? I'm not sure. I'm really not sure.
I think that we are overwhelmed by two things. One, our environment. We pick and choose what we want to know about our environment because if we paid too much attention to it, it would overwhelm us. Mm. I think, though, that we are also overwhelmed by the awesomeness of our freedom and the responsibility that comes with that incredible ability to change the way things are, that they won't be different anymore because of what I have done. Now, some people will say that I had to say what I just said because the neuroscientists or whomever will argue that we are determined by our brain states. And I'm quite confident that my brain has a lot to do with what I do, but I don't think in any meaningful way anybody really believes we're determined by our brains. We still get upset if we get mugged. We still get proud when we think we accomplished something. The neuroscientists who say there is no good or evil because of our brain states will still show you their CV because they're very proud of what they've accomplished. They will get frustrated if a colleague rips them off, in their research or their data or takes credit for something that they did. Responsibility is inescapable. And I think that we can be overwhelmed by both our capacity to define who we are by what we choose and what we don't choose and by our environment and learning how to get some sort of focus on both of those things is a very difficult task and is a lot of what growing up is about. And many of us never quite get there.
So you said you spent the year studying religion and science on your sabbatical.
That's right.
Right. So when the neuroscientists say that free will doesn't exist, that all these decisions made, I can think of, I have a list of people here that we've, James Egan Holmes from Aurora, Jared Loeffler in Tucson, Adam Lanza, Newtown, Eric Harris, and Dylan Klybold in Columbine. I can go on and on and on and on. The kid in New Orleans who we don't know who fired the gun into the crowd, wounding all those people, any number of people we can think of, that didn't have free will. They were conscious of what they're doing but couldn't control what they were doing.
Of course they could control what they were doing. I mean, they may have been very much influenced by brain states, by psychological states. We are all acting within our environment. But I don't think that you're ever going to convince me that these gentlemen had absolutely no control over what they were doing. They did it. It wasn't done. They weren't a happening, right? They weren't the front end of a wave of reality coming at us. They were people, and they did these things. And they had to negotiate their environment just like the rest of us have to negotiate our environment. And they went one way. Most of us go another way.
You know, one of the things, come back to a social thing for a moment. Unless you're about to say something, Chip. Is that the quote that you just made a minute ago, Bernard Keels, of Martin Niemöller. I was just kind of Googling and looking it up again. Martin Niemöller was a German theologian who made this famous quote people use all the time. First they came for the communists, and I wasn't a communist, so I didn't do anything. Then they came for the socialists, and I wasn't a socialist, so I did anything. Then I came for the trade unionists, and I wasn't a trade unionist, and I didn't do anything, and on and on. And then they came for me, and there was no one left to defend me. I was alone. He started out as a very conservative, even anti-Semitic religious thinker. And then because he opposed the Nazis taking over the churches, they came for him. And he wrote this later in life about his own life and what he learned. So can we build a culture on what we learn from the past, that maybe you can't ever do away with what we call evil? I mean, it's always going to lurk, because it's part of existence. It's always going to lurk there somewhere. But can you build a society where it is not as present in human consciousness, that it is not what fuels what happens in our culture? Or is it just part of who we are as human beings in human society?
I don't think life is all that complex. I think that for me, one of the most wonderful things to discover is that there really is a value and a meaning in every individual that I come into contact with. I just met you this morning, and I'm really, you know, delighted at how you think as a radio talk show host, and it's very provocative. I remember when Professor Shipp came to chapel, I didn't know she was a Pulitzer Prize winner. But I can look in her eyes at some point and knew that she was a deeply thinking person.
Mm-hmm.
And as we talked after the service, it made sense to me. Same thing with Dr. Pettit. The first time I met you, I think we talked about my Orthodox black Jewish neighborhood that I grew up in, that I'm currently living in. What I'm getting at is this, folks, that there are no shortcuts to understanding. There are no instant recipes to say that if X, then always X. Sometimes X can be influenced by the dysfunctional nature in which it was introduced into the equation in the first place. We've got to be about truth-telling. We've got to be about acknowledging errors of the past in order to move forward. All my life, I've done that, and I think that, excuse me, in religion, it's so difficult to do because people assume that everything is what it is. Someone says, well, I read it in the Bible. I'm saying, wow, well, then who translated the Bible you read it in? You know, because the Bible you read it in Pauline doctrine says that runaway slaves be returned to your owner. So it was night for Christians to say we should own slaves. But the question that begs to be understood and has never been really dealt with in any academy, any social study tank group, is the absolute preponderance of one culture dominating everybody else's reality, to the point where you could say everything in your life was discovered. And I always ask the question, have you ever read Who Discovered Europe? To me, that's a very important missing link about the world, because I was standing in Victoria Falls about 10 years ago with a young man who spoke Shona, and the guide, who was a guy from the former Rhodesia, was saying, you know, about Livingston discovering the falls. And this kid went berserk. You know, he said, you can't, you know, what were the name of the falls before he discovered them? And why is it all of a sudden he discovers them and forever they're called Victoria Falls? To me, that's a false assumption about the ontological nature of how things exist. If they don't exist that way, someone's got to be able to be brave enough and say that it's wrong to sit by, as happened in Brooklyn 20 years ago, and watch a woman being raped and everyone's in their apartment buildings. And, you know, it's New York and people are saying, well, it ain't me. Well, it's wrong to see a kid come from the community on campus and shoot someone and say that's a horrible, evil act, but you need to find out what precipitated it.
Mark, a couple of years ago, I got an op-ed into the Baltimore Sun on Christmas Day, and it was reflecting on Stanley Tukey Williams, who was on death row in California.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there was a big debate going on as to whether or not he should be his death sentence should be commuted. And I argued in the piece that both sides had it wrong, both the pro-execution and anti-execution, because both of them were working with an understanding of the value of a person that could change. It could go up or down, and then you decide where that person is on the value ladder, and you decide whether they're important enough to commute a death sentence or not important enough to execute. And I contrasted that with the religious perspective. And the religious perspective finds a radical value in every single person, whether it is greater than a wish-fulfilling jewel in Buddhism, whether it is the image of God. I like to refer to something I call the slightly less than God club, because in Psalm 8, the psalmist is looking up at the heavens and wondering about the significance of humanity. And the answer they get back when they say, who are we? Or who am I? Why do you care about us human beings? The answer, at least in my translation, is you are created a little less than God and crowned with glory and honor. And so that means that simply by virtue of who we are created a little less than God. And so we belong to the slightly less than God club, I like to say. If we could, to get to the society you're looking for, do a better job of meeting everyone as a member of the slightly less than God club or as somebody greater than a wish-fulfilling jewel and start our interactions with them with that presupposition. If our governments were structured to treat people that way rather than to say some people are better than others, these children deserve more money for their public education than these children simply by virtue of where they live because we will fund public education by local property taxes. If we could, both in our personal interaction and our politics, do a better job of committing ourselves to radical dignity or radical worth, I think we'd get some way in moving away from evil.
That's a good statement. If you follow that, then it would seem to me that it would take, at the very least, an ability to recognize the sacred worth in all human beings. And whether one understands them and knows their story or not, that this little less than God club is an excellent concept, because one of the things that I see in that psalm is this profound sense of there will be a person you will meet for whom you know nothing about, and if you give them value, you can come to a quick assumption about them. You must actually learn their story, hear their voice, hear their cries, hear their supplications. And what you don't know, you need to then ask, who are these? Where did it come from? And then in Revelation it says, these are those who come through great tribulations. Well, part of what those three women in Cleveland came through is amazing, because the whole community, no one did anything until they were freed. Everyone wanted to take credit for it. You had one guy saying he freed them, another guy saying he freed them. And my thinking is, how do you let an Errol Castro exist among you without taking the time to know who he is?
But we do that all the time, don't we?
Don't we?
There's so many people who we don't know, who walk past all the time, have no clue. We make assumptions about them, and people in my profession do that all the time, and we help to shape how we see the world, how the world is seen. We have a huge role in helping to shed a spotlight on some of these things that we think are evil, but we don't. Somebody on that in that block, Seymour Avenue, I think it's called in Cleveland, somebody must have thought something weird about that house, about the way that man carried on and wouldn't let people in the house at some point, apparently. But it was probably too much for us to say, well, I don't want to get involved. I don't want to be nosy. He's just a little strange. He does make good ribs, but otherwise he's a little strange. But, you know, okay. We do that all the time. We try not to get involved. But we in the media will jump on a story like this, make it the most important thing ever, and then drop those bigger questions that we're raising this morning. We won't go back to try to investigate, well, how could this exist? What were the notions of the power, relative power of men and women? Were these particular women just runaways, throwaways? I don't know. We will drop that story in a hot minute, but I know I got to shut up.
We got to end this piece in a minute or two, and I because what you're saying is important. I think it's a good place to leave off to come back with maybe to talk how we look at these stories and what we need to do to look at these stories in greater depth as we can wrestle them, not just say they're news stories and leave them at that. That's what we're trying to do today. And let me just leave an email, a Facebook thing that came through a moment ago. And I apologize, Josh Moore, for not getting right back to you. But Deborah Ricks wrote in, it's a great topic, Mark. And yes, all of us are capable of evil. And I'm one of those women that was raped at 8:16 at gunpoint, she writes. She's a producer here at WEAA. And a lovely woman. So I think that we need – what I like to pick up with another time is when we think about this misogyny in our world today, we think about what happened in this kind of great evil that unfolded itself in Cleveland. Is can we build a society where that consciousness is less than it is today? Can we change human consciousness and the way we think? And how do we do it? So we'll leave that for another day.
Yeah.
And invite you all back and some others to wrestle with that. And I want to thank you just heard E.R. Shipp, associate professor and journalist here in residence in the Department of Communication Studies at Morgan State University. Dr. Josh Miller joined us by phone, lecturer in philosophy and religious studies here at Morgan State University. Dr. Joe Pettit's in the studio, associate professor of philosophy and religious studies and religious studies advisor here at Morgan State University. And the Reverend Dr. Bernard Keels, who is director of the Morgan University Chapel. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And you hear these four brilliant people in our program today in this first hour. It's a good reason for you to consider Morgan State University with professors like these. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we are going to talk about Top Dog, Underdog. One of the things I've been thinking about lately is that some of the greatest thinkers we have today are playwrights, and many of those playwrights are women, and many of those new playwrights are black women who are writing things that need to be heard. So we'll wrestle a little bit of that and come back with one of the actors in this new play, and then we'll talk about Malcolm Shabazz at the end of next hour with some people who knew him, worked with him, and what he really meant and who he really was, and not the way places like USA Today try to portray him in handcuffs. We'll be right back. Stay with us.